This episode is brought to you by the Marine Corps Association and Modern Day Marine. Attention, Scuttlebutt listeners. Prepare for an incredible experience at the Modern Day Marine Expo, happening April 30th to May 2nd at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center. Dive deep into military advancements and networking. Plus, the Objective One Wargaming Convention is back for its second year. Expect nothing short of awesomeness, so bring your A-game. Don't miss out. Secure your spot now. Also, Nancy, William, and I will be on site recording episodes live from the showroom floor. Come by and say hi. Visit MarineMilitaryExpos.com for more details and to register. That's MarineMilitaryExpos.com. Hope to see you there. We would like to thank the Marine Corps Association and Modern Day Marine for sponsoring this episode.
Hey, Scuttlebutt listeners. Thank you for joining us for another action-packed Scuttlebutt episode. I am Vic. I'm here with Nancy.
Hi, everyone.
Don't shake your head. This is going to be fun. This is going to be great. We are continuing on with our segment, Catching Up with Old Friends. And I think when we first were brainstorming this idea, the very first name that came up was Casey Tellison. And so we got him here again. Friend of the show, Casey, thank you so much for coming on, man.
Always a pleasure. Always. I'm just happy somebody emails me. You know what I mean? So I saw your guys' name. Like, hey, friends. Nice.
Said no one ever. I'm happy someone emails me. What?
Well, it's not spam or work stuff. So I'm like, this is pleasant, you know?
Well, okay, good. To really make it challenging, you know, according to what we were talking about before we hit record, is we're going to start sending you requests for faxes, and that'll really.
Well, now I know how. So I'm reversed in this ancient technology, so I'll be ready.
You're going to walk back into that FedEx with like, he's back. He's back. He's going to ask for this weird thing. Check
Double
it out.
Double the price. Yeah.
Yes, right. So Casey, thank you so much again. This is your third time being on the show, but for those folks who have sorely missed the first two, if we could just talk a little bit about who you are. I obviously acclaimed award-winning published author, former machine gunner, Marine machine gunner, now not just a law graduate, but now a practicing attorney in Spokane, Washington. Casey, go.
Yeah, that seems, well, it's always weird too. It's like just even someone calling me an author too. That's always funny. I still to this day don't really feel like one. I don't know when that changes, if that ever changes for people. And the same is very true for the attorney thing. You know, I just like, oh yeah, you're an attorney now. I'm like, am I? Does that, are you sure that I am? Yeah. So, well, thank you for the
that must really give your potential clients a really warm, fuzzy feeling, to a feeling of confidence when you respond with, am I?
This is all internal dialogue, right? I just, you smile and nod and you act like you know what you're doing. And then you kind of get all the information. You're like, well, I'm going to go look everything up now because I have no idea what this person is talking about. So, you know, after spending hours alone, then you're like, I think I know what we're talking about here. So,
yeah. Well, so, like, I will say, we keep stepping on each other, Rick. I will say that our third conversation, you're sitting there in your office, Casey. I can see you on the video call here, and you just look so much more relaxed than you did when you were law student, Casey Tellison.
That's, I guess I'm learning to fake it better. You know what I mean? I'm just learning to present a better, more relaxed pose.
You were in bar prep hell last time we saw you.
That was a lot more stressful than I anticipated. I don't think I gave the devil its proper due there with what a monumental task the whole bar exam thing is. So lessons learned. I hope I never have to experience that again. Actually, today, some of the people that didn't pass with me, they're taking the bar exam right now. So I felt so bad for them. I just felt so bad for them, you know, because it's a test that a lot of people say if you study really hard, you could, you shouldn't fail, you know, but there's also, there's certain amount of topics that you can study, right? If you put all your eggs in one basket or six baskets instead of the nine baskets, then you could not get the topics that you studied for, and you're just in hell at that point. You're just trying to make it up, which never goes well. So my heart goes out to all those people. And there's a lot of first time takers right now too. So fingers crossed for them.
Yeah, I can imagine that taking the bar multiple times would be like every time you graduated boot camp, they would say, oh, dude, your paperwork's jacked up, man. You got to go back and do it.
It was funny. I don't think I told you guys. So when I was taking the test, I go in. It's in Yakima, Washington, and it's in this huge banquet hall, essentially. And they had set up these giant bars with chains that held the timers, the countdown timers that give you how much time you have left. And it's huge digital red numbers that are counting down this whole time, and they're hanging from chains. I'm like, this is literally a version of hell that I'm in right now. You know, this is like some kind of weird, like mellow Hellraiser situation that I'm in. Yeah, just incredibly nerve wracking. I'm like, you guys, you probably did this on purpose, right? Like, you had to order these clocks and chains to put this whole thing together.
This is premeditated. Like, you didn't just like, oh, hey, this is the cheapest thing we could find on Amazon.
No, this was like, you probably had to custom order this stuff too.
I'd like to have been part of that brainstorming session just to see how that all played out.
Yeah, if it was just one sicko that like went rogue and did this whole thing, it was just like, I'll handle the clock. I'll handle the clock. Everybody else can deal with everything else. But yeah, it's a good one to have in the taillights, that's for sure.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, congratulations again. Very excited for you on that. So, I mean, how things been, you know, now that you are a practicing attorney, man? You're in an office, you're doing the do.
Yeah, it's been good. It's I think it's like everything else ever, to where you get done with the training in the school and you're like, well, now is when I have to actually learn how to do this job. Because I just, you know, schooling, when the rubber meets the road, it never matches up to what the practical application of stuff. So I'm just trying to learn as much as possible and just, you know, luckily, you know, writing over the years, I've got tough skin. So when my partners tell me my work product sucks, I'm like, okay, I've done this before. This is just a draft. We'll fix this in draft 2, 3, and 4. So I can see where some like younger attorneys who haven't really experienced that might get their feelings hurt a little bit with some of this feedback. But I'm like, this is fine. It's just a whole different medium. You know what I mean? So you got to take that with a grain of salt too, which it also makes it kind of fun for a writer too, because you're placed in a box, right? There's all these parameters that are set around your briefs and stuff like that. And so you have to still find a way, at least for me, to find a way to still get enjoyment out of it, you know, and still have as much fun with the language and the sentence structure and just the structure of the overall briefs as possible. So it's kind of like, in this super dry, mundane world, how can I make this as, you know, interesting to read and as funny, at least for me to read? Because some of the stuff I'm going to have to read and revise, you know, 6 different times. So I'm like, I'd rather enjoy this too. So anytime you can have fun with a sentence or stuff, something like that, I always go for it.
Nice.
That's so cool. Yeah, I can't imagine, like, do you find that your creative writing experiences and background have helped in your legal writing?
100%. Yeah, they certainly have. Like one of my main goals always as a writer is concision and brevity, you know, and that's something that's like a unique quality in the legal writing world. So if you can really distill, and that to me, that always, like, I don't know if it's correct or not, but to me that like connotates mastery. If you can take a complex idea and distill it into a simple sentence.
Sure. So yeah.
I feel like in the law too, like if you can, a lot of this stuff is insane. There's Latin words, there's phrases that mean absolutely nothing to anyone who's not a lawyer. So if you can kind of explain this to either the judge or the jury or someone like that, or even your client, in a simple way, it kind of shows that you had mastery of the situation, and that a judge or whoever is reading your document can be like, oh, we're just having a conversation here. Even though we're talking about complex things, I can understand this and easily follow it. So it's just, I think the good writing is just good writing, regardless of what you're trying to do, you know? So, and I think that, you know, you take some of these tools that you learned in, you know, fiction, nonfiction writing, that kind of stuff, you can really apply it to any kind of written product you had to turn out.
So what I hear you saying is, for all you younger Marines out there listening, write and write some more.
Yes, 100%. And just keep writing. You know, now I'm legally obligated to continue writing forever. Yeah. So, but it's you do, it is a perishable skill, you know, and the inverse of that is the more you do, the better you get at it. So, but if you take a long hiatus, you're going to be rusty. You know what I mean? And so the more you read, the more you write, the better you get, just like everything else.
Yeah, I was going to say throw a read in that, in between the writing stuff, make a little read sandwich out of it.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And then, you know, really read some high level stuff so you realize how much you suck. And then you fill yourself with enough existential dread that you're like, I have to continue working at this because these people are so much better than me. So that's another common tactic that I use, too.
Yeah, actually, one thing that I find it's interesting, you mentioned that, one thing that I found as I was reading, you know, through the creative writing program was, obviously, everything is like high arts stuff. But then going down to some of the more lower, you know, the softballs, if you will, but like say read like Cormac McCarthy and then like crack open a Harry Potter book. And there's a lot of art in that, even though it's very corporate and very like, you know, clearly this is for mass consumption, but there's an art to that as well. Like if you're always doing high art, you lose that. I think you lose sort of that ability then to make things digestible. And so then your ideas, even if they're unbelievably profound, are so abstract that they're just, they're lost on everybody else.
No, that's an incredibly good point. And I think that, I think I maybe have pissed some people off by saying this, but I feel like that's one of the pitfalls of an MFA program is oftentimes you're writing to your MFA classmates or your professors.
Yeah.
Right. So what you're doing is you're not writing anything that anyone else wants to read other than this, these 12 weirdos that, you know, and so if you can't make it digestible that where, you know, your average Joe or Jill wants to read it, then it's like, I don't know how useful it is. I mean, do it, you know, I mean, always do whatever you want to do. But I'm saying, like, if you want to connect with other people, I think that's a good point that you made. Like, digest some of this. I don't want to say lower level. I don't know what you want to call it, but digest some commercial fiction stuff. You know what I mean? And see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
More something that's more accessible.
Yeah, and I read, like, my reading pattern is like I read a couple of books for pleasure, and then I read something I'm supposed to read, right? Some kind of important book that I'm woefully behind on all my reading list as a poor person. I never got to read a lot of the stuff as a kid. So there's always these books, these classics that I'm supposed to read. So I'll intersperse that between the stuff I like. And I like genre fiction. I like horror is probably my favorite like genre to read. And so I'll read some trashy horror stuff and then I'll read an important book. And I, for me, it gives me a good balance, you know?
Yeah, no, that's great.
Okay. Well, so what are you reading now?
Oh yeah, totally.
I don't want to, it's certainly not, I don't know. I regret saying trashy horror stuff, you know what I mean? Because some of it's just fantastic, you know what I mean? So I'm reading Don't Fear the Reaper by Stephen Graham Jones. I think that's the author's name. This is the second book in an expected trilogy. And so it's essentially like, it plays with the trope of all horror, both fiction, like writing and movies and that kind of stuff. And so all this stuff's kind of breaks the fourth wall a lot. It's just very good. The guy's just a fantastic author. You know, he's written some really, he's like maybe the hottest like horror dude out there doing it right now, not named Stephen King, really. I really enjoy his work. And Stephen King, who I adore, right? I've always just been an enormous fan of his work. My mom got me hooked on him when I was a kid, and I just kind of always stuck with him. I finished his newest book, and I regret to inform people that I do not recommend it. But which is kind of a bummer.
Okay.
But, I hope there's no possible way he hears this, but I hope he does.
Yep, he does.
I'll let him know. You're
doing something very right on our end. So don't fear the Reaper. So I wonder if Stephen Graham Jones is a big Blue Oyster Cult fan too.
I'm sure it's in there somewhere. You know what I mean? He does a really good job of, like, in a non-tacky way, integrating a bunch of pop culture, you know, and it in a way.
Yeah, I mean, with a title like that, man, it's gotta be intentional.
Well, it's such a clever move too, because, like, there's so many stereotypes and cliches with the horror genre, right? And so it's I would assume, having never, like, published anything in that genre, that it's hard to not just fall into these tropes, right? Not just repeat these things that have always been done. So what he's doing is he's taking all of these tropes and acknowledging them, and then creating something with all of these tropes that's kind of new and unique by acknowledging them. And it's just a really interesting piece of work he's putting out there.
Yeah, that's great. I read, I'm going to Google it really quick because I'm going to butcher his name. But the book is called Getting Filthy Rich in Asia. Is that right? How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia by Mohsen Hamid. Speaking of tropes and using them as part of your narrative, is he writes the book as like a one of those do-it-yourself books, kind of like in this thing you're going to do this and you're going to do this, but then as you're reading it, you'll realize that he's actually telling, in a lot of ways, a story about himself and his upbringing. But then also in this sort of fictional world as well, but it's all told from the second person. Mm-hmm. Then you will do this, and then you'll meet this woman, and then you'll get married, but then you're going to cheat on her, and then you're going to be in this, like, it's so great. But it's a lot of what you're saying is that it's fiddling with those things that you just come to expect that have become sort of very mundane, and then just giving it a little twist, man, it just makes it so fulfilling to read.
Yeah, and that's like one of the things when anyone sits down to tell a story, it's like, how do I tell this story? What form? And if you can come up with a kind of an interesting new form that could really work for you, or it could be one of those weirdo MFA things that you should avoid at all costs. So it's a fine line you got to walk. And it's like, just because people can do it well does not necessarily mean you can do it well. You know what I mean? So I think that's, I can't remember who said it, but a person's got to know their limitations. They really do. And I count myself in that group immensely so, because you just got to, sometimes you start working on something, you have a great idea, and you're like, I just don't have the tools to pull this project off. You know what I mean? I should shift gears a little bit. Not saying try.
Or do it your way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Try and do it your way. Because.
And there's always, it's always worth trying. You know what I mean? It's always worth going down that road and seeing where it leads, because you might not have, it might not be the form that you choose, but it could turn into something that you're going to integrate into the overall form of whatever project you're working on. It's all useful. I don't think it's ever wasted time.
Yeah. We had a poet come and speak to us. I'm one of many, but this guy stuck out in my mind, although I can't remember his name. So I guess it wasn't that profound, but, what he basically said is, like, don't be afraid of being derivative. Mm-hmm. He said everybody's so tried so hard and they're so focused on having this original thing that everyone's missing out on the beauty of deriving an idea from an existing idea. He's like, if we were all so concerned about being original, not being derivative, like, the only original story is like the Bible, you know, it's like, everybody has in some form or fashion. And that's part of what you're talking about. Like, the mastery of the craft is that ability to ingest these wonderful expressions of art and then making them then your own. And so, don't be afraid of being derivative.
Yeah, that's just an excellent point. And I think that's an essential phase of maybe anything you want to do, but it's certainly writing is where when you first get started, what you're going to do is you're going to copy your heroes. Like you're just going to write how they write because that's what you consume. That's what you like. Right. So I think that through, and that's why it's such a long path to find your own voice, because you have to try on all these different voices. And once you try on all these different authors and you try to copy them, eventually, once you've put enough stuff into the meat grinder, your own voice starts to come out. And that's just, I think that's just, it's unavoidable if you actually want to take writing seriously, that you're going to be derivative of other people. And the hope is that you've exposed yourself to such good quality work that that derivative thing that becomes your own voice is something people want to read, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So how is the reading then going for you now? You've got a, so, and I think it's a universal thing for lawyers, but you guys have to do essentially like what in the Marine Corps we would call like PME, right? Like, do you have to do like a bunch of, what is it? You have to take a certain number
like continuing
of
education.
Yeah. Right.
It's a certain requirement. When you first start out though, me being a boot lawyer, you have a certain amount. I think I have 2 years to fulfill all my credits, but then it becomes like, I believe it's every 2 years you have all these credits to fulfill. And really it's just, as people will recognize in the military, death by PowerPoint, you go to a class and then they try to kill you through, you know, spreadsheets and graphics that zoom in and make funny noises. But that's pretty much it. But there's also a lot of like, you can just go through the motions, you know what I mean? Like I'm sure a lot of people do, or you can kind of tailor it to be like, this is the field I'm going to go into. So I'm going to take this serious. I'm going to go to this class and actually try to learn something. Because most of the time, the people that put on these classes are practitioners, and that'll be their field. So if it's like a land use person, this will be the land use guy in Spokane or in Eastern Washington. And it's more fascinating. Yeah. But that's a weird phase of my life when like land use stuff excites me. So I might have to reevaluate some things, but some things are in. I mean, you could go even different, you know what I mean? There's, you can go like, you know, wrongful death stuff, all that kind of fun stuff, but it's, you'll go there. And then a lot of these people that are presenting will be the guy, right? And so you'll be able to really learn from someone that's been doing, and it's like everything else, you know, you don't really know how to do this job until you put in the reps. And so if you can actually talk to somebody that's been in this field for a long time, I mean, they've likely forgotten more than you could ever hope to learn. So there's a lot of value there. If you, like everything else, there's value if you actually go there with an open mind and actually try to learn something. So it's not as horrible as I initially made it sound out to be, but.
Yeah, it's interesting. My wife, when she was practicing, just sort of backed into being the subject matter expert for a digital evidentiary stuff. Mm-hmm. And so like things that people were posting on their social media could actually be used as evidence, but all of the sort of graybeards like had no idea how any of that even worked or whatever. And
they were still using fax machines.
She's like, she was like leading these PMEs for other graybeards on like, careful what you're posting online. And
I know it's very funny too, because a lot of other than graybeards, we'll call them senior practitioners. That's a good word.
There you go.
Practitioners, they won't even know how to make a PDF. So when you start getting into like digital discovery and like what does self-destructive messages mean? Like, are there messages that self-delete? Can you still get those? There's just a lot of ins and outs. And it's a good thing, just a good mental note for everybody listening, that all of your Facebook messages, Instagram messages, Reddit messages, these things are discoverable. So not that we all do it, but before you draft something, think like, how would this play out in court? How would this look up on a big screen in front of my peers? You know, something to think about. That's why phone calls are good. Phone calls are good. If you're going to get testy with someone, maybe have a phone call first before you send that email.
Well, if phone only calls we are had good. Devices that we could carry around with us, that you could actually press on the buttons and then make a voice call. They need to come up with something like that.
Yeah, hopefully.
So I read a headline the other day that what is the young Gen Z, that they have their phones. Now, I have not fact checked this, full disclaimer, that they keep their phones on do not disturb because they don't want the anxiety of having to answer the phone. I haven't fact checked it, but yeah, that's a thing, apparently. Anxiety about answering the phone.
I mean, don't we all have it a little bit? Like those, I mean, it's kind of crept into our lives a little bit when, like, you see someone actually calling, you're like, oh, shit, I'm going to have a conversation. But, you know, I don't know. It's hard to say because my son, he's 14 now, but he's kind of he's my kid, so naturally he's a little odd. But he literally, I don't want to sound too hippy-dippy, but, like, when people say old souls, like, my son was born a 47-year-old accountant. He just was. Like, that's how he came out. So he's very personable. He can talk to people. You know what I mean? He's kind of a throwback. So I don't think I have a good sample to really talk about the younger generation.
Oh, man. That's awesome.
That's fine. Well, I want to change directions a little bit. Kind of in keeping with the theme. Overruled, right? In keeping with our theme, keeping up with old friends. So we wanted to talk to you about keeping up with old friends, Casey. Have you kept up with your Marine Corps friends? If so, why? And do you think there's value in that? And why is that important?
It's a very good point and a very good question. There's a core group of my friends who are pretty much the same core group that I would always hang out with, that I served with, that I still keep in contact with. There's a couple of guys I talk to either once a week or every couple of weeks. And it's, I don't know, Nancy, if you remember John or Kyle that you met at the award ceremony. They were the great big tall guy was Huth, who I write about in my book. Yeah. And then the little short guy, which is kind of funny because they're complete polar opposites, that's John Sheldon. And we both talk a lot. And it's always great too, because every time you call them, it's like you get in a time machine, you know what I mean? And you're it's like no time has passed and you're right back to where you were. And it's just, for me, it's essential for my mental health and just my, so I don't scream at people, you know what I mean? If I can just talk to these guys and we can, sometimes we talk about the old days, most often not, you know, but, it's always just, you feel better after you talk to these guys. I'm not sure what the mechanism is, what's the play there, but for me, I've got to do it. I would say there's three guys I contact, like I said, on that weekly, biweekly basis. And it's, like I said, just essential. I think that it, you know what I mean? It kind of keeps you tethered to that old world, but it also allows you guys to kind of have a commonality of a shared experience. And then you can also talk about just the shit that you're going through as an adult trying to figure out how to do this thing. You know, just about everybody has kids except for John, so we have questions about him. But everybody else has kids. And so it's just good to commiserate with all that stuff.
Well, and I was going to ask specifically if you think it's so key is that shared experience, that you're not telling each other your stories, you're not bullshitting with each other. You already know your stories. And so you've got that shared experience and you're moving forward from it. You don't have to sit down and tell your life story to someone new. You've already got these brothers, you know, essentially they already know your bullshit. They also know when to call you out on your bullshit, right?
Yeah. And they also know when to maybe sense that things aren't going so well, you know what I mean? Or they can pick it up in your voice. Some of these people know you better than even your significant other might know you in some regards, you know? So it's just, I mean, I guess it's nothing revolutionary. It's just, you know, deep friendship, you know what I mean? The kind of spawning out of a shared experience, but it's, yeah, like I said, if that tap was shut off for me, that would be a major problem in my life. You know what I mean? If I didn't have those communications, if I didn't talk to those guys. So I just urge people that are, maybe even if they don't do that, I hope people are doing that. But if they haven't, just reach out to these people and you'll be amazed how you can just pick up where you left off. And it's, you know what I mean? It means a lot too. Just a weekly or even once a month, just a phone call. It might not mean a lot to you making the call, but the person that gets the call or opposite ends, like, it can make a difference. I really think it can.
What about you, Vic? Do you have Do you have a group of people you served with who are still your friends and you stay in touch with them?
So Hunziker, Mike Hunziker, who I was actually texting with yesterday. I got a couple, not as many as I would like. A lot of folks that I would love to get back in touch with. I think in some respects, one of the things I found with adulting that I've had a lot of trouble with is trying to make new friends. Essentially being a Northern Virginian now at this point, but all of my support network is in California, or from my Marine friends who are just, you know, all over the country. You know, I do most of the male interaction I have are the dads of my kids' friends, you know? And that's always so weird, right? Cause you're like, hey, bud, how's accounting, you know, or in this area, it's like, oh, hey, how's it being a GS-14 or, you know, whatever. Just trying to break through and actually having a genuine sort of relationship or connection is so difficult. So I do find, you know, I guess to echo a little bit, and it's a long way of doing it, but to echo what Casey was saying is when you are with those people that you have either, you know, friends of mine that I grew up with that I'm still in touch with, or my Marine friends that I'm still in touch with, I can say a word and we both have memories that are connected that just completely unlock. And there's entire worlds that are available to both of us. I won't get that with someone that I meet, you know, as a 47-year-old, you know, father of two in an area that I didn't grow up in. When I say, hey, John, you know, how's the weather? You know, whatever. There's not that shared experience. But when I, you know, I'm talking to Hunziker and, you know, I mentioned, you know, hey, remember our chaplain used to get so hammered at the ball, you know, like, and now, you know, we just unlocked like this whole thing. Like, oh yeah, I remember that Catholic priest used to get shit faced at every ball, you know, at all of our balls. And so it's difficult. And so, yeah, I think that just to also, again, echo what Casey's saying, like, I mean, do not lose that. You know, I poo-poo social media, but if that's the way to stay in touch with people and to continue to connect with those folks you have all these shared experiences with, you got to do it. Because if your life is just the sort of superficial, how's the weather sort of interactions, it's gonna be very lonely, even if you are constantly surrounded by people.
Yeah, and to kind of tie it back into our previous little mini conversation about phone calls, like, I feel like phone calls are where it's at, like actually talking to these people, hearing each other's voices, you know what I mean, and just getting that experience if you can, you know, any opportunity to get together physically with these people too, like, don't, if you've got the opportunity, you should really try to take it, you know, because for me it's just really good medicine, you know what I mean, it just it really is, and it just lets you go back for an afternoon or something, you know what I mean, and then it not only does it let you go back, and then it kind of helps you put things to perspective on like how far you've come, how things are going, you know what I mean? It's just good.
Yeah. And I think too, also for them, for your friends, I think probably they'll be more willing to open up to you than they would even, you know, to some of these other folks that they may consider to be friends, but they just don't have a lot of life experience with. When you ask them, how's it going? You're probably going to get the real answer, right? Mm-hmm.
It's just an invaluable thing that, like, we have. If you know what I mean, if you kept in contact with your friend, like, a lot of adults don't have this, you know what I mean? So this is something that we have that's you know what I mean, I don't know how many adults have like an adult friend that they really can open up to and talk about all of the shit, warts and all, you know what I mean? I don't know what the numbers are. I it doesn't seem to me like it'd be too high, but you know, if you're a veteran, you went through some stuff or didn't go through some stuff, but you shared some experiences with somebody, like, you've got a unique thing that you should really, for lack of a better term, just exploit to its fullest potential. Cause it really is beneficial. Certainly in my case it is.
Yeah.
Have you done any formal reunions? I mean, other than just informal friends getting together, have you done any reunion groups with the Marines you served with? As a group, I mean.
I haven't. There's been, I believe there's been two of them that 2-3 has put out, and through one of those, a couple of those big organizations that put together these reunions. I haven't been to either of them. I don't know. Like, I don't know how I, that experience kind of scares me a little bit. You know what I mean? All of that stuff, all of those people once, I don't know. I've got my core group of friends that I talk to all the time and stuff. So I think for me personally, I would like to keep our informal reunions a thing, you know what I mean? And get together. I just don't know how I would like one of those. I can't knock it because I haven't tried it, but I don't know how I would like one of those things. I should probably just quit being a wuss and actually go to one. But I got a good system right now.
If for nothing. No, I was just going to say, if for nothing else, you know, you go to one of the bigger reunions just to be able to sit in the corner with your close friends and like shit talk everybody else or the events or, you know, like the dudes in the balcony from the Muppet Show.
Well, and that's exactly what I know it would devolve into. So I'm like, I can probably just skip that step and we can just do this on our own. But
yeah, that makes sense.
Like, you don't have to be here for me to talk shit about you.
Yeah, no. Trust me, we're doing fine. Yeah.
So what about your writing, dude? If you Google Casey Tellison, you're going to come up with a bunch of stuff, man. Are you, now that you're, you know, all hoity-toity attorney at law, are you doing much writing anymore?
Not as much as I should. It's been like a kind of a New Year's resolution for me to kind of force myself to get back into it, because I've just been using my both parental and employment obligations as an excuse to get out of this time, you know. And regardless of how I try to frame it, be like, well, I should be I'm billing hours, you know what I mean? I'm billing hours. I'm doing like the whole purpose of me going to law school was to have a job that would support my writing habit. You know what I mean? And so I've reversed those things, and now I put the real writing and my real passion on the back burner, and it's just unacceptable to me. So I'm trying to be more draconian with myself and being like, you know what I mean? Like, no more. You know what I mean? I even like, it could be oversharing, but like, I've even like told myself, like, I don't get to drink anymore until I finish my next book. So like, there's like a pact I'm trying to keep with myself, as far as like, you have to start punishing yourself because you are not doing what you're supposed to be doing. So now you're going to start losing privileges, Casey. So starting with this. So I'm just trying to be tough with myself and trying to stay motivated.
You're NJPing yourself.
100%. Yes. Next step is half rations. Yeah. Bread and water. I realized that I had to go back and make some fundamental changes, you know what I mean? Because I was falling into the trap that I've seen other people falling into and just letting a passion die because of other stuff. So I'm just like, you got to be ruthless with yourself, and you've just got to hold yourself accountable. And that's what I wasn't doing. So that's, I'm on the path trying to fix it. I hope next time we talk to you, I haven't completely fallen off and I don't have anything to show for it. But things are back to starting to write every day. You know what I mean? Words are coming easier. The creative stuff's coming easier. So I'm hoping if I could get just at least a shitty first draft of my book done, my next project done this year, I feel like that'd be a big win. But we'll see what happens.
Do you have any representation that's looking this stuff over?
No, this is not fit for human consumption yet. So this is, this could be completely toxic in the wrong doses to people. So I'm no other eyes other than my wife so far.
Well, with the success of Freaks of a Feather, like, are you getting propositioned by publishing houses at all? Like, hey, when's the next great Casey Tellison book coming out?
No. So if there's any publishers listening, like, what the hell's going on? Am I not pretty enough? You know what I mean? Like, what?
We'll put your personal number in the show. Yeah. Show just like,
what's wrong with me? Okay. But no, I haven't really. Just the uncomfortable conversation with family and friends telling me, like, so when's the next book going to be out? And you're just like, oh, yeah, cool. I'll just write another one. No pressure. No pressure.
Yeah, let me just pull that out of my ass.
Yeah, right? It's not like I used all my tricks on the first one, and now I got to come up with new tricks. So, it's good to be back. It's good to be back to a certain degree, back in the creative process. Like I said, I get to apply these tools and work and stuff, but it's not the same. No matter how much I try to lie to you guys, it's just not the same. So it's good to be back and trying to get that old creative brain working again.
Well, if you want to test the waters with a short form piece, you always have a home in Leatherneck.
Well, thank you. Have you guys had Worth? I might have asked this before. Have you guys had Worth Parker on yet?
No, we have not.
Really good guy. He's the one that helped Schumann write his book. Anyways, I owe him an essay.
Okay, I do remember you mentioning him, yeah.
Yeah, I owe him an essay, and if I don't get it to him in the near future, he's going to start coming after me. So that's like step one, I got to get him an essay. He's trying to put together a really cool project with different essays from different veterans, so I'm trying to work on that. And every now and then when I'm sitting, if I have to go to ex parte court stuff to get documents signed or anything, I'll handwrite this essay that I'm working on for him. And that's been a good experience for me too, to get back into handwriting stuff. I think it's because one, my handwriting is so terrible that when I go back over it, I really have to think about what I wrote because I can't hardly even read my own handwriting. So, and also like the time it takes my brain to get to my hand, that's a certain level of time difference than it is typing. I could just be crazy here, but I feel like it creates somewhat of a different product and kind of allows me to be, maybe think a little more before I actually put it down on the page. That could be fake, but that's what I feel. And so it's been good to do some handwriting stuff too.
That's a good tip.
Dude, we talked about this not too long ago. Maybe it was with Olalu, but I mean, yeah, if it's fake, it's also real, man. That's a thing, dude. I think that it really is a thing, like that creating that separation and having like all those synapses and muscles and everything doing the work, you know, connecting your brain to your thoughts. I think it's a real thing, man.
And it builds in a two-step process because you obviously have to transfer this into a Word document. So you're forcing a rewrite session, which is...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah, nice.
A lot of people won't do that. You know what I mean? So if you build a system where you have to rewrite it, well, now you've done essentially two drafts. You know what I mean? It just gets a little bit better and a little bit better. I'm not saying write your whole, you know, novel that way, but I think it's a useful exercise and it's something that you could get a lot out of. I really do. Especially because if like you're working on a larger project, you got to chop it up into little pieces. And maybe you're just thinking about one scene that's essentially, or one stream of conscious thing that's going to eventually wind up in your work. It's good to kind of work on it outside of this imposing Word doc that you have that has X amount of thousands of words. It can sometimes be intimidating when you open this thing up because you're like, I don't want to put shit in this document because it'll poison the rest of everything. You know what I mean? So if I can just smear shit on this, you know, legal pad, that's different. You know what I mean? And that might not, if it's bad, it might not infect whatever else I've gotten going on in there, which is also a crazy person thing. But you know, like Vic said, if it works, it's not stupid. So
that's right. That's true. Vic is wise.
I just open my mouth and shit comes out. So I mean, every now and again, there's a nugget in there. But I will say though, there's a couple things you're saying that actually were echoed when I was in my MFA program, and that is the idea of just opening the file. Like sometimes that's the win that you need that day, even if you didn't even touch it. But the fact that you like intentionally went into your whatever hard drive or your computer or whatever and mouse clicked over the thing, found it in your file system, and then opened the document. A lot of times that's the win that you needed for that day. And don't discount even taking being that intentional. And then this idea that like, well, all you need is really 15 minutes. We all know how that goes. You know, 15 minutes of writing for some people could mean a 45-minute chunk of time. So you don't necessarily work on it that way. But when you open the file and you're intentional about it, and then to dovetail off of your handwriting thing is, and if you're also carrying around a journal, a writing journal, then you're sparking that creativity, you're getting the juices flowing, and then somewhere else along the day, maybe while you're away from your computer, you have a thought, and you just start writing the thought down. Mm-hmm. Like you said, sort of absent of this monolith, you know, this mega document that you've created. It's you're sort of separated from that, so you write the stuff down. And then, like you're saying, you're then forced now to transcribe that onto a Word document. So you're getting multiple looks at it. It's away from your file. So yeah, journaling, I think, is huge, which I don't do. I mean to. I carry my journal around, but I don't, you know, I don't think that because I'm saying the shit, I do the shit. But it doesn't mean it's not really good advice. But yeah, I think all of those things really help get you into that mode. It's almost like a writer's liturgy.
Yes and rituals, you know what I mean? Like, it's, you've got your thing you do, you know what I mean? And it's also good to, like I said, like, impose kind of new things too, so you don't get into that same funk, because then sometimes, like you were mentioning, even your traditional ritual becomes terrifying, you know what I mean? Like, you're like, oh no. Yeah. I'm ramping up to do the thing that I'm dreading, you know what I mean? So if you can kind of, sometimes if you're hitting walls, just remove yourself, go someplace else, do something different, but still be working on that vein, you know what I mean? Even if it's you know, taking a 30,000 foot view and outlining some stuff that's not actual, like, hardcore creative, it's all part of the process. And you can you can do stuff to move your story forward without actually writing your story. And I don't think people should shit on that. And you know what I mean? Being like, oh, you didn't hit your word count. And it's like, well, do whatever works for you. You know what I mean? But like, it's a good point you made about just move the ball forward the best you can. And if you can do this every day, eventually the ball's, it's going to get there, you know? I'm fortunate where I have no, like, I hear some of these guys have these insane deadlines for their stories and stuff like that. So, like, I think I've joked about it before, like, I'm on the 10-year timeline. Like, if you know what I mean, at the end of the day, like, but if it gets done in 10 years, like, that's a big win for me, because I'm not beholden to anyone with this stuff. So I can kind of take my time on it and do something I'm proud of and do something I'm not trying to churn something out. I can see how that'd be a rad position to be in if you've got a big contract and you've got to churn out big dollar. I'm not saying it's not cool, but like, for me, for some of the stuff I'm working on currently, like, this is some stuff that for me needs to gestate, needs to need to come back to it a few times and do some stuff with it. Like, which is, I was going to bring up a point. If you've got long form stuff you've been working on for a long time, and then you leave it, you know what I mean? You let it rot in a file cabinet somewhere. For me, it's necessary. It's kind of a daunting task, but I will, to get back into the project, I will retype everything, right? So I'll print.
What a great idea, though.
Yeah, it's painful, you know what I mean? And it's frustrating, but it's like a way to, for me, and like, I think this is maybe the interview where I've come off as the most crazy, but like, the to get back into that person that was telling that story, I need to go back into those words. And if I retype it, I start getting back into that mindset and the things start clicking and firing again. And I can kind of get myself back to where I was when this story was the most important thing in my life. And it's, I told some people this and they're like, I'm not doing that. That's too much work. But for me, it also, like, it's, one of my tremendous tools for procrastination, because I think it's being productive, you know what I mean? So if I'm restarting, it's just, you're picking up wins, even though you're not creating the new stuff, you know what I mean? But it still feels like you're winning. And so it just helps me with the whole creative process when I'm working on this longer stuff.
That's interesting. Huge. I mean,
good, Nancy.
No, I was just going to say, I've done a similar thing. I'm now going to be admitting this for the first time. I'll go back and listen to, if I'm working on an article, and of course, what I'm writing is a very different type of thing, but I'll go back and listen to the interview all over again, and sometimes sit down and start transcribing it again for the exact reason that you mentioned, so I can get back into, like, okay, what was I thinking about when I heard this statement the first time? you know, not quite as dramatic as retyping the entire thing, but a similar concept.
Yeah, same premise, you know what I mean?
Yeah, Vic, actually, I think say? That's a good way too. Like, if you're working on a word count, sort of, you know, if that rigid word count goal is something that is helping you move that ball forward, I think that would be a really great way of getting that word count, staying creative without having all the pressures of having to always generate new content.
And, you know, tying it back a little bit, like, it's another way to build in another draft, because this time you're going through, yeah, you're doing it again, you're catching things. And this is also a time when you're going to start, because you get that kind of insanity of the initial draft stuff that comes out, and it comes out fast and it comes out quick and it's euphoric and it's fantastic. But oftentimes it doesn't make sense and it doesn't connect with everything else, right? So when you're doing these forced, you know, rewrites of drafts, that's when you can start recognizing, oh, these are themes that I was trying to get at, and I can start teasing these things out to make them actually have an impact, you know. And sometimes you're doing this consciously, sometimes you're doing it subconsciously with these multiple drafts. And so you can't emphasize enough how important multiple drafts are. You know what I mean? Just because your first draft, as Hemingway said, is always shit. It just always is, no matter how good you feel about it. You know, it's just not going to be good. And if you have the discipline and you can subject yourself, I haven't seen this. I'm sure it can happen with like crippling OCD and stuff, but like where it starts to get worse. But I've not seen a situation where my drafts, as I go forward, have gotten worse. For me, they always get, for me at least, subjectively better, you know what I mean, as I go forward. So it's just for people out there writing and struggling with this word stuff, like, it's okay to just have the draft and start over. And if your first draft is nothing like your second draft, even better. Doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Just keep
even better. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Totally. So how, I guess for my turn to shift gears, how has been a practicing attorney been? Like, is expectation met or expectation completely, you know, decimated, or how's it been, man? Because it's been 6 months now, or?
Yeah, it's like I'm kind of, like I said, I'm a boot. You know what I mean? I'm just still a boot attorney. I haven't done anything dramatic yet. It's kind of like when a Marine hasn't been on a deployment yet. You know what I mean? They're still a boot. I haven't done a trial yet. So I haven't actually gone in and talked to a jury and like tried to really do the quintessential lawyering stuff that you've seen on your local television station. So I won't know until I know. I haven't done that stuff. The work I have done, I have enjoyed. Like, a lot of people find, like, because I'm helping out on a lot of civil litigation stuff, and so a lot of people find the discovery process, like, horrifically boring when you have to sift through all these documents and read text messages and emails, all this stuff. But for whatever reason, I really enjoy it. You know what I mean? It's just a weird thing that sometimes you're reading through all these text messages and you're getting this like just this section of this person's life, and you can really kind of like, again, get into the story of what's going on. And then the whole time you've kind of got your facts and your issues of the case that you're trying to transpose onto these texts and emails. So it's like a treasure hunt, kind of like you get excited when you're like, you're reading through, you're like, oh, I got some juicy stuff right here. You know what I mean? Like, this is it. I found it. You know what I mean? So it's kind of fun. It's kind of daunting because you might spend, you know, literally 12 hours just reading through emails that are completely meaningless to your case, but it's all building to this kind of, you know what I mean, this crescendo of like, I found it. I found the one email in 1200 that's going to make a difference. So I've been enjoying it. It's fun. It's been humbling for sure. You know what I mean? Just because like, you can be, like I said, you can be somewhat accomplished. I don't know what you'd call me now, but like you could be an experienced writer. Maybe that's a better term, but like, you still have so much to learn. And so that you have these people that, you know what I mean, maybe haven't dedicated their lives to writing so much as I have, but like when it comes to this legal writing stuff, they are elite and I'm just a novice. So like, it's been humbling to like turn out a product and then have one of my partners here just like rip it to shreds. And then, you know, being able to be like, I deserve this because this actually wasn't good. And what I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing. And like just getting these practical tips from these practitioners that have been doing it for a long time. I hope it's making me a better writer overall, but I know it's making me a better attorney. And so I'm working with a lot of super smart people. And so it's just like, I feel like just by osmosis, I'm getting better just being around these people, you know, like I might be lowering their average right now, but hopefully they kind of bring me up to their level, you know? So
like it's entropy, right? It's entropy. Yes, they're exactly. Dropping, you're rising.
Yeah. So hopefully I don't bring them down too much. You know what I mean? But it's been a really great experience. There's just, at this firm, there's just a complete wealth of experience. One of my partners, he's office down, hopefully he can't hear me, Matt Crotty, he does a lot of USERRA work, like representing veterans in discrimination acts and that kind of stuff like that. And he's done it for years and years. And he's one of the just, you know what I mean, just this guy in this office in Spokane just happens to be one of the USERRA experts in the United States. You know what I mean? Like he's very sought after all over for these veteran discrimination cases. And so just, I feel very fortunate that I kind of just through blind, dumb luck, I just landed at this fantastic firm.
That's awesome.
What field of law is it for doing or dealing with Idaho cannibals? Is that its own specified field?
You know what I mean? That's just your wrongful death. Like it's your initial wrongful death, run-of-the-mill stuff. And from there, it just gets more interesting and more interesting and more interesting. Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. To say it gets more interesting, I love that. To say that it's run-of-the-mill and that it gets most interesting, it's like the largest understatement. Like that.
Like I said, it's one of those deals where I hope after representation's done, this is something I can write a book about because it's incredibly interesting. But just like, I don't know how, other than like the firm or some like legal thrillers and stuff, I feel like there's like an absence of legal books written for the common person, for the lay person who's not involved, right? Because any kind of books, most books written by lawyers, the average person would rather gouge their eyeballs out than actually read it, you know, because it's for like the MFA stuff, it's for these other 12 weirdos in this certain particular aspect of law. Okay. So I would definitely want to try to, in my upcoming projects, maybe kind of explore even short form stuff as far as like what this whole industry is actually like, you know what I mean? Because even before I got into it, I had no idea. I just had no idea. I just was like, well, I'm going to be a lawyer. You know what I mean? And I had no actual idea what the thing was. You know what I mean? I didn't even understand like how lawyers got paid. You know what I mean? I didn't know, you know, just went to school. And then I'm slowly like realizing how this whole thing happens as I'm in school. I'm like, well, it's too late now. So here I am. So one really good book that stood out to me that I read before, because it's like one of my things that I do. If I'm going to go do something, I try to read a bunch of books about it before. And I found there was a severe lack in the creative nonfiction for this kind of stuff. But I don't know if you guys have heard of Scott Turow, author.
Yes.
Yeah. Wrote Presumed Innocent, which I think they turned into a Harrison Ford movie. But his...
Yes.
I believe it was his first book. It was a nonfiction book about his first year of law school. It's called 1L. And it's very good. You know what I mean? But it's like the only book of that ilk that I've ever seen. I'm sure there's some out there, but it's really good because it's like, if I remember correctly, Scott Turow's not a wealthy fella. He wasn't at the time. So it's like this poor person with a wife going through 1L year of Harvard. It's just very fascinating because he's also... And he's a creative writing guy. I think that was what his undergrad was in too. So maybe that's why I connected with this guy. Cause I'm like, oh wow, we have some similarities here. But it's just interesting. Cause he goes through some of the same things I went through as far as like, you know, initially you go in, you're like, well, I'm clearly the smartest person here. You know what I mean? And then you realize very quickly, am I in the top 50% of intelligence here? You know what I mean? Did they accidentally let me in? You know, and so you kind of start to get some of the same things. But it was a good book. And I think I would like to kind of mess with that kind of idea. Maybe, again, only 12 weirdos would find it interesting. But it's something I kind of want to explore.
Oh, that sounds cool.
It seems to me like it's a lot of your commencement speech in that theme.
Yes.
Which I think is extremely compelling, because from someone who suffers very, very, almost debilitatingly so from imposter syndrome, I can so appreciate that sort of perspective and a narrative that captures that. So yeah, go for it, man.
Yeah, it's one of the horrifying realizations as you become an adult, is you're just like, wait, nobody actually knows what's going on definitively, like at all. No one's in charge. You know, it's kind of horrifying. You're like waiting for the adult to show up and like, oh shit, it's me. I'm the adult, and I don't know what the hell I'm doing. It helps you kind of reconnect with your parents a bit, give them a little more sympathy. Yeah. Like I thought totally. You guys were messing it up, but I get it. I totally get it, and I'm. Yeah. You know, we're in this together.
Just doing the best they could with what tools they had. That's all they could do.
And then you think about what the tools they had back then, which was almost nothing. So you can kind of move the bar a little bit depending on what generation you're talking about.
Yeah, I feel like if I ever become a ghost in someone's house, I'm going to be the ghost that walks around whispering, I get it.
you just hope they're not bitching about all your design choices in the house, about like the paint and everything like that. They're just like, who the hell would paint a wall this color? That'll be a little insulting. But.
All right, Casey, man, dude, this has been so good. I'm going to have to let you go, or we're going to be here all afternoon, man. I know you're in the office. So, but dude, thank you so much for catching up with us. And dude, we'll be in touch.
Sounds like a plan. Thanks again for having me on.
Thanks. Right, good man, talking good to you.
This episode is brought to you by the Marine Corps Association and Foundation. Did you know that when you leave a gift to the Marine Corps Association Foundation in your will or estate plan, you help ensure the future of our professional development programs for Marines? Leaving a beneficiary designation gift is a simple way to support Marine Corps Association Foundation, and you can designate us as a beneficiary of a retirement account, life insurance policy, or bank account. This gift will cost you nothing now, and you are not locked into a decision you make today. You can learn more about planned gifts by going to the Samuel Nichols Society page on the Foundation's website at www.mca-marines.org/foundation. That's www.mca-marines.org/foundation. We would like to thank the Marine Corps Association and Foundation for sponsoring this episode. Scuttlebutt is a production of the Marine Corps Association. You have heard the voices or contributions from Major Vic Rubel, USMC retired, Nancy Lichman, and or William Truding, and Casey Tellison. Ty Frazier is the editor, sound engineer, and technical producer. The Marine Corps Association is not an agency of the U.S. government. The opinions expressed in this episode are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the official position of the United States Marine Corps, the Department of Defense, or the Marine Corps Association.